Hello, listeners. Jordan here. I just want to let you know that you can listen to Nighttime early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focused on the fringe of Canada.
Hello, listeners. Tonight we are again going to return to the evening of January 1st, 1970, in the city of Winnipeg, Manitoba. But this time we aren't going to sit back and listen to a story. Now that the story's told, we have the opportunity to consider the many elements of the crime that ended the life of 11-year-old Geraldine City. And I have some friends who are going to join me for it. This isn't the first time this has happened, but this time it was intentional. At roughly the same time I released my episode covering Geraldine's case, my friends at True North True Crime released an episode covering the same story. We figured by timing both of our episodes, we can hopefully kick up some interest and some discussion in this case. And part of our plan was to wrap things up together. And that's what we're going to get into tonight. In this episode of Nighttime, we'll be joined by the hosts of True North True Crime. And our topic is the still unsolved murder Geraldine City. True North, True Crime. I'm proud to be caught up in another True Crime podcast eclipse with you. But this one was a bit more intentional and planned than the Tanner Krupa one that we found ourselves in 6 months ago or so.
Yeah. Accidentally, we found ourselves in the same case that first time.
Yeah.
Whereas this time, we both kind of realized it at the same time and reached out to each other to say, "Hey, we're both covering this. What do you want to do?"
Yeah. Well, I don't know how you found out about this story, but I was in touch. I heard from the family spokesperson who was just kind of letting me know about who was the guest on my episode. Who was just kind of letting me know, you know, here's the story. I'm looking into it, trying to figure out what happened to my aunt. I right away was like, I'd love to have you on the show and share the story and, you know, dig into the story with you. Very shortly after that, he had told me that he was also talking to you. Did you learn about it the same way? Like, you were in touch with the spokesperson?
The exact same way. Actually, he sent a very detailed and compelling email that really sort of attracted us to the story, but we were kind of swamped in a few other episodes that we were working on at the time, so we had to put a pin in it until now. I don't think it was too long, though. I think it was only a month that we kind of left it off to the side, like on the side of our desk.
Yeah, I the exact same experience here. And it's like, but I don't know how you do it, but on my show, if I get a lot of like story recommendations and ideas from listeners, but if I ever hear from someone who's like a family member or really close to, or a victim or really close to a crime, I do what I can to drop whatever I have planned and prioritize that. But both of you and I, we had talked about this and planned it this way so that we'll work on it, release our episodes at the same time or near and about the same time, and wrap up the episode like this, because I think talking about the story and telling the story is one thing, but then taking what you learn and like going back and just kind of unpacking it all like we did with Tanner Krupa in that past episode a few months back, I think that's really valuable too. So I think the way this has worked out and the timing of it has been fantastic. But before we get into talking about the case, let's talk a bit about you for people who are watching or listening on my show. Would you introduce yourselves and True North True Crime?
Hi, everybody. We are the hosts of True North True Crime. We are a true crime podcast based out of Vancouver, British Columbia. And we're a real life husband and wife couple who started this podcast in May of 2020. We're both true crime people. We're both big podcast listeners. It was actually something we bonded over when we first started dating. And then many years later, 4 years later, we were able to start our own podcast. And the podcast has sort of found a life of its own since we started working on it. Each episode is a deep dive into a missing person or a victim of violent crime that has a connection to Canada.
Yeah. And we like to We like to kind of call ourselves an ethical true crime podcast. And we, you know, we really would encourage listeners to get involved into any kind of GoFundMes or Facebook pages that we drop at the end of the episode. We want people to get involved and really be as big of a part of the cases that we cover as they possibly can, you know?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So sometimes just being that supportive person who joined their Facebook page is enough. It just shows support. Like, it doesn't have to be financial and you don't have to solve the crime. But just to let people know that there are good people out there is such a huge thing for families.
Oh yeah. And anyone who follows your social media, it's like a mix of here's the content we created and how to find it with like advocacy for the families that are involved in the cases you've covered or just whatever's going on in your community. So I see that advocacy is a really big part of what you do. And this story, Geraldine Sitte, it's ripe for someone like you and your kind of style of coverage and reporting to get involved, because it's, as we've already talked about, the Geraldine's nephew serving as the family spokesperson very much came to both of us in search of a platform to share their story and in search of more advocates to help get behind the cause of, you know, getting this case reopened or getting facts to come to the surface. Because it's sadly, like many cases, it's found itself, you know, cold. And it's largely unknown. Like, since releasing my episode, I've heard from several people who said, you know, I've never heard of the story. One particularly said, I grew up in that town in that time frame from the, in, you know, 60s and 70s, and I had never heard of this. And I responded to say, like, you know, something must have been different back then with the way, like, tragic stories were covered in the news. Because if this happened today, an 11-year-old girl murdered on the way to a convenience store, it would be news all across the country, and it would be a huge story, and people would be demanding, you know, the highest level of investigation and reporting and coverage. Where in Geraldine's case, this thing happened and it's basically buried to the point that even her family didn't know a lot of, you know, the details of what happened in the courtroom. Like, when you heard this story and read the facts of the case, what were your initial, you know, thoughts on this?
Well, I think for me, I can't believe that it's essentially been completely forgotten about, not just in, you know, Winnipeg or Manitoba, but the entire country. A lot of people reached out to us after saying, thank you so much for covering this. I hadn't even heard her name before or, you know, any of what happened. I think what stuck out to me was, you know, a person of interest is, you know, has been found, but nothing has happened. And it's just kind of frozen. It's cold. It's so cold and nothing is happening. And I feel so badly for this family and everybody that knew them and knew Geraldine. And I just think it's time, obviously. I mean, it was time
50
a
years
long time ago.
Ago,
yeah. 50 years ago
to really, you know, light a fire under some butts and get this moving again.
Yeah.
And I agree with what the nephew had to say. We asked him, like, why did you do this? Why did you reignite this story? And he said that when he goes online to search about Geraldine Sitte, maybe two articles come up. Mm-hmm. One is a CBC article in which they talk about multiple missing or murdered women. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is, like, I think there's a blog up there or something like that, but there's very little information. And that in itself it's not actually a crime, but that's a crime. Yeah. And so now I believe that, like, with our two podcasts and this episode, now all of a sudden we start to have an internet life of Geraldine Sitte. And like what the nephew had said, is now if somebody gets excited about helping with this case, there's something online that they can hold on to. Now, Geraldine has a personality now between our two episodes online.
Yeah.
That's a little bit more fulsome and a little bit more of a 360 approach to this family, you know,
as well as even just like new photos and stuff. The only photo on the internet was of her that I could find was the one associated with the CBC article. And it looks like somebody photocopied an old news, like a thumbnail from a newspaper, and then photocopied the photocopy like 30 times. And
it's
then
terrible. Yeah.
And then put it on CBC, where now the family spokesperson connected with different members of their family and got some photos, had them scanned. Now there's, you know, if you search her name now, you're going to find some better photos to, which in a story with a murdered 11-year-old, when you see her face and you realize this is just a kid, it just brings a story to life a lot more than this super old grainy little photo on the CBC article ever could. Now, we should just be clear with this, is if people listening or watching are probably like, it's weird that they just keep calling him the nephew or the family spokesperson. There's been kind of some back and forth about whether or not they want to remain anonymous. And if you listen to our episodes and you know the story, I think they can be justified in considering anonymity, because this is a case that I think is on the cusp of something happening. And there are certainly people out there that don't want anyone digging into Geraldine's story. That's what I think.
100%.
And even while we were researching the case and speaking with him, his family again got a harassing phone call. And as we get into this case, we realize that harassing phone calls were the preliminary behaviors of the person who may have murdered Geraldine. So to me, it was very, it put a chill down my spine that they got a harassing phone call within the last 30 days from a blocked phone number. Mm. And the cell company, of course, they're not going to reveal where it came from unless you go to the police, because a blocked number is a blocked number.
Oh, yeah. The way phone calls come into this story is just bizarre. So before we get deep into talking about it, let's just kind of recap the facts of the case. Sure. This takes place on New Year's Day, January 1st, 1970, in Winnipeg, Manitoba. 11-year-old Geraldine Cité was home with her father, Leonard. And I couldn't tell if she wanted to go to the store or if he asked her to go to the store, but regardless, she gets $1.30 and her transistor radio that she got days prior as a Christmas present.
It was the previous Christmas. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And she's running to a neighborhood drugstore that's like, I think like 5 minutes away.
Yeah.
It's a couple blocks away. And she I think when people hear the story, they may be like, 11-year-old girl never should have been going out at night. But when
it was
1970, it was in my 9-year-old, like I have a 9-year-old, and there's areas that he's allowed to leave the house and go to, like he has friends up the street and that's fine. And there's been tons of times where I'm going to go call for my friend five houses up. And I'm just like, yeah, whatever. I think in their case, this was something like that. It was a safe neighborhood. And he's like, the dad would be like,
she had done this walk before many times.
And according to one of the articles, Leonard, the father, he looked out the window. He saw the bright lights of the street and he saw people on the street. And St. Mary's connects with Fermor, which, if I remember correctly, Fermor is actually Highway 1. Going through St. Vitale. So it's a slowed down, it's not highway speeds, but it is a busy intersection. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yeah.
If you're looking for a smoking gun, I can absolutely guarantee you will not find it.
In October 2001, a series of letters filled with a deadly powder called anthrax were dropped into the U.S. mail system. What started as an unprecedented case turned into an unsettling mystery. Who sent these deadly letters, and why? From Campside Media and Sony Music Entertainment, I'm Josh Dean, and this is Cover Up Season 4, The Anthrax Threat, available now.
So Geraldine goes off to the store. When she doesn't return back in what would have been a reasonable amount of time, like I think it was like 20, 25 minutes, dad gets worried and shortly after that realizes that the store, the drugstore she was going to, wasn't even open that night. And I can only imagine, like, with that realization, like sheer panic would have kicked in. He checks with, you know, friends in different places as to where she may have been. No sign of her, and basically the search is on that evening is about the timeline of that night. The next morning, the discovery of Geraldine's body in a nearby vacant lot is how I understood it. Did you ever And when I say discover your body, she's been murdered, multiple stab wounds. So it's like something horrible has happened. Money and radio weren't taken. So
no motive for robbery or anything like that.
No motive for robbery. And what the spokesperson told me is that there didn't seem to be any kind of like sexual nature to it either. So it's just one of those situations where it's just like, what the hell happened? Even the police chief did a statement at the time that was quoted in one of the newspapers where the police chief simply said, we seem to have a kook on the loose.
Yeah. 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 A demented person. And And I think that speaks to the motive and even the sex assault aspect of it. Not to muddy the water yet, but there were previous attacks in St. Vital of young girls, teenage girls, at knife point. And in one of those, the perpetrator masturbated, and then let the person go, the girl go. So interesting. We know that there were no signs of sexual assault, outward signs of sexual assault
but
or physical signs,
with the others either.
But we don't know if it was sexually motivated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like maybe nothing happened sexually to physically. Her, but you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And we got into that in my episode. I'm sure you did as well, but it was, I think it was just like a couple weeks prior in the same area. A young woman was walking through like an alley, kind of like a darker area or a more isolated area. Someone with a knife, as you described, forced her to watch them do an indecent act on themselves. And they described the person who did it as like a young man, which becomes interesting as we get it to the first arrest or to the only arrest that was made in Geraldine's case. But in thinking about what the motive could have been, this is where we get back to the phone calls. And the only thing that really seemed odd, like Geraldine, as far as I've known, didn't have any enemies. There was nothing that would have made her, you know, risky. Like, of course, she's an 11-year-old girl, so what could have happened? But one thing that stood out was, I believe about a month prior to this happening to her murder, she received like a bizarre phone call that was very upsetting. And it's often been thought that this phone call is connected in some way. Do either of you want to kind of explain what you know about the phone call?
So from what we understand, it was December 5th. Mm-hmm. So it was right at the beginning of December. Geraldine received this phone call, and it was a young male voice. Mm-hmm. The person said he knew her and then backtracked in the middle of the same phone call and said he didn't know her. But there was like a reference to maybe being at the same school as her. Mm. And then he continued to be suggestive, vulgar, and derogatory, stating that he was watching her. And this is an 11-year-old. Like, I can't, like, the amount of times that we said this is an 11-year-old girl in our episode is probably, like, if we did a search on it, it's a lot. Like, I can't emphasize this enough. She was 11 years old. Yeah. And then the person hung up. She told Leonard, her dad, about it. Not much you can do with crank calls back in those days. Even if it was being traced, it would take a minute. And so the person would always hang up before it got to a minute. And then it turned out that the same thing was happening to other teenage girls, young girls in the same 10-5 blocks area throughout the month of December. And this is also when things escalated into, we believe that there were three different reported knife attacks between December 1st and New Year's Eve. And then Geraldine was murdered on January 1st. So there's escalating behavior in the same neighborhood. All of the girls either went to
the same age. They have the same, like,
they all went to Norbury
School.
They all went to either Norbury School or Windsor School, which was the two K-9 schools in the area. So we have like, it's a very small circle of time, and it's a very small victim pool.
And also, I mean, what are the odds that in a town this small that these things are not connected?
That's what I was thinking when I was
talking,
when I was looking through the old news reports, talking to the spokesperson. was the same. I came to the same realization, like the same opinion immediately. It's like the phone call, these other cases that involve a knife, all involving what is described as a younger male being involved. Like, there's no way it has to be connected. It just would be too coincidental, if not. And it seems like if that happens, this you would think would be a very solvable case, or at least to the point that they have a few suspects. We really know next to nothing about the investigation, but we do know that the investigation eventually did lead to a suspect who I think was a 16-year-old boy that was arrested and charged in Geraldine's murder. But this is what surprised me, is when I was talking to the spokesperson, it seemed like his family really wasn't involved in the investigation or trial or anything, because they seemed almost like they were almost like learning now that the charges were stayed. There was no conviction.
Yeah. So we had a person who was actually 14 at the time of the crimes. It was a 19-month investigation. So he clearly had two birthdays during that time.
Okay.
And was 16 when he was arrested. This is the thing that, I do some work in restorative justice, and the thing about restorative justice as opposed to criminal justice, and I think they both need to exist, is that restorative justice involves the victim and involves the victim's family. And it also involves the community, whereas criminal justice does not. The victims, like victim impact statements, have only been around for 20 years. Whereas something like this, a crime like this occurs, and the Satie family
would have been left out.
Left out. They had no idea this. So the kid gets arrested. He gets bonded out on $10,000 bail. And then at some point, nobody knows when, his charges are stayed, which means that the Crown can pick up the charge again if they want within a year. But they didn't. And nobody knows why. And the family was never, as far as we know, there was never a phone call. There was never an invitation to court, because we're also dealing with a young offender, which, and rightfully so, young offenders should be protected. There was talk about moving him out into adult court. It didn't happen. Something happened that made the Crown look at the facts of this case, either the confession, the interview, the evidence. Something happened, and it was not in the world of justice, or for the good of justice, to move forward with this case, and nobody knows why.
But there was something. Like, what I would love to know is what led them to this suspect or to this person that they charged. Like, they must have had something significant to actually press the charges. But then again, it must not have been significant enough for them to go forward. I would love to see the details of it. And it must be driving the family crazy, especially the spokesperson we both spoke with, who, like, I'm sure they would love to get their hands on the investigator's files. Although one other thing that surprised me is they had told me when I was interviewing them that they did meet with the investigators, who seemed very open with giving them information on who the suspect was and, you know, how old he was, how old he is now, all that stuff. So he did get some information, but I would love to see all of it.
And including the other charges, because from what we understand, one or possibly two, again, he's a young offender, so we'll never know exactly, but we believe that one or two of those other assaults were charged.
To the same person.
So why couldn't they connect
Geraldine's
stabbing to the other transactions that occurred within the same month?
Mm-hmm. This would have been before DNA, of course, in the 70s. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's, I'm just like, I keep thinking about the passage of time and how different things would be now. If this had happened now, I don't believe the public would have given up. There would have been so much attention on a brutal murder of an 11-year-old that also involved the suspect having been accused of like rapes and weird sexual crimes. It would have been such a big story that it wouldn't have gone away. And just in this case, it did. And it's so shocking, because it's a horrific crime, but it's also a simple and easy to tell crime. And that's the kind that really capture the attention of a nation. And I think I just can't believe that this happened. Although when you say the 70s, it doesn't sound like a long time ago, but it was 50 years ago.
I know. Can you believe that?
But also generationally too, you have to think that, because when I think about my parents and stuff, you know, when the law or the government or the doctor or whoever the quote unquote authority is tells you something, they generally took it as fact. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that there wasn't questions going on in the 60s and 70s, but I do know generationally, a lot of people assume that the law was the law.
Mm-hmm. And that they were, you know, doing
their job. Even the spokesperson said it. He's like, you know, I just assumed they got the wrong guy. Mm-hmm. And nobody wants the wrong guy to go to the wrong person to go to jail. Mm-hmm. But the more he looked into it, the more he's like, it's still pointing to this person. Mm-hmm. So I think there's also that aspect to it was, you know, back in the day, it was like, well, cops and the judge said they got the wrong guy. So I guess that's it.
Yeah, I don't think like nowadays there's such a it's almost assumed that when something happens, there's going to be like a hardened group of advocates that are fighting for justice and going mm-hmm. on the news and talking and getting the story out. And yeah, I don't know if that was.
Oh, no, 100%. That was not around then.
Yeah. In a big Métis family from Matheson Island. You know, they're from an area with a population of 100 people. And now they're living in St. Vital in the suburbs of the big city of Winnipeg. You know, it's, you know, are they question authority type people in that type of power dynamic?
Yeah, it's true. It's it would be a different kind of vibe than it's, you know, the mayor's daughter, you know, like something like that. It's
a young Indigenous girl, you know, like, I mean, we can say that it would get a lot of attention today, but I don't know, would it?
Yeah. Good point.
And it's like, I don't want to have to be the one to bring up that, but I mean, I think it unfortunately didn't get enough attention because she was a Métis girl at the time. Mm-hmm.
And that's something now where people in media, they're really trying to correct that and highlight these stories. When we're talking about the 70s, like today we're trying to fix the problems that kind of became routine then. So this would have been a time that a story like this would be, you know, would be buried. And the time frame, like the era that it happened in, certainly plays a huge role in this 100%. Case not being well known. And I think it plays a big role in it not being solved.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also we've worked on other cases from Winnipeg at that time, and I'm not critical of Winnipeg Police Service or St. Vital at the time, but there, you know, the Barbara Stoppel case is a case that we covered, and you know, there were some mistakes there, and also, you know, in her crime, her murder was never really solved. Mm-hmm. And we've been lucky enough to speak to a former Winnipeg police investigator who believes that he has solved that crime. Huh. But there was sort of patchy work at the time. And then cases just kind of disappeared. And we moved on to the next news cycle mm-hmm. because it was literally newspapers. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, 24-hour access to the internet.
It was much harder to keep people's attention. Then it's much harder to create, I think, a compassionate connection with victims because they're not seeing their faces. Yeah. They're not seeing videos of these people. They're not seeing the victims' families' faces on, you know, TV or the internet every day. It's harder to develop that compassionate connection with the family members, with the victims, you know, back when this was occurring. And I think that's why it's so important for, you know, you and us to now tell these stories on new platforms to a larger group of people nationally or even internationally. And it's time to, you know, get these older cases solved or at least, you know, some sort of justice or some sort of closure that the family can have.
My dream would be, I mean, obviously for it to be solved, but 'cause it happens. These cases do get solved even 50 years later. It can get solved.
Oh, yeah.
But how about an official written explanation for the family? Mm-hmm. You know, just to say, hey, you know what? There were some balls dropped. We can't get into what they were or whatever it is. And just explain, like, instead of just like, well, his charges were stayed, you know, just an explanation to the family. So they know. And again, this goes back to the restorative justice thing mm-hmm. is include them in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because somebody, and the family's been dealing with that for years. And what I think is really heartbreaking is when I think, and this is me talking as a dad myself, is the guilt her father must have felt after her death, being the one who let her leave. And I think it, like, it was, you know, the run to the store, and I think he wanted her to get cigarettes as well. And I can't imagine, but I can try to imagine what the rest of his life must have been like, dealing with, like, his little girl, like, this happened on his watch and he wasn't there to protect. Like, I can only imagine the stuff he was thinking. And he's passed away
he passed away 2 years later.
Yeah. Without no, like, yep. those last 2 years of his life, I don't know, but I'm willing to bet it was a living hell that entire time. And it's, yeah.
So they started getting harassing phone calls after the murder.
Yeah.
And the caller indicted and was horrible to Leonard, saying, like, it's your fault your daughter died. Like, that's, so, you know, was that a random kook who read the newspaper that day, or are we still dealing with the same main suspect?
And, you know, yeah. And I don't know if we should get into the phone calls. They haven't even stopped. They're still said to be people, like, causing trouble. We won't get specific with it, but phone calls have just been a part of this story right from, you know, a month before Geraldine was killed. So we talked about what had happened, the police investigation, what her dad had likely had to deal with for the last 2 years of his life. Now that there's the suspect that was arrested and charges were stayed and he was released, this person, like the spokesperson, and lots of people on the internet know who this is and knows about, we're not using his name because of libel and slander and all that stuff.
Yeah, but and young offender, and like there's a lot.
It's very complicated. But I've seen people writing about him online, and people know who it is. And I don't believe they've ever made a statement. And whether or not they did it, somebody did it, and somebody's out there living with this for 50 years. What will it take, do you think, for this person to get caught? Is it going to be a relationship breaks down and someone he told, you know, tells the police? Or is it going to be a deathbed confession?
If they ever do, I mean, here's the other thing is, you know, they could think, I've gotten away with this for 50 years, I'm not going to give it up now. Or, you know, they could find some humanity within them and say, you know, I'm going to say what I did. Or, you know, somebody knows, somebody saw something that night, somebody didn't realize who it was. And now that her photo has been shared a little bit more and her story's been shared a little bit more, maybe the right person hears it. Maybe the right person reads what we've been posting or more CBC articles or anything. And maybe somebody comes forward that knew the person that, you know, overheard a confession
Has suspicions. And the spokesperson had told, the family spokesperson, Geraldine's nephew, had told me that there was close to being movement in this case a few years back. Someone was going to testify against the person that they believed was responsible, but I think there was like an overdose or a sickness that led to them not being able to.
We didn't even put that in our episode because I was like, how do I even put this in? I don't, you know.
I think what it speaks to is the fact that things must still be happening, but it's like a waiting game. And when someone gets, if there's just not enough evidence, even if the police are like, I'm pretty sure it's this guy or girl, and there's not enough evidence, you just kind of have to wait for a marriage to break down or someone to, you know, get in a fight with their lifelong best friend, and their best friend's like, I'm going to the police about that thing you told me when we were drunk 6 years ago.
Exactly. Or we get back into good old-fashioned police work. They have they have 5,300 pages in Geraldine's file, you know, we know that you know, St. Vital police became Winnipeg police and RCMP took over and stuff. So we know that there's been some bounce around. We know that new buildings have been built and old buildings have been destroyed. We don't know what has been lost.
Exactly.
But I do believe that there's got to be something in this 5,300 pages that points to the one person who did this.
Or hopefully some sort of DNA or blood evidence that has been kept over the years that we could, you know, use the technology that we have in 2021 to maybe make some movement on this.
Yeah. And also even like with somebody coming forward, like so many witnesses are terrible and they're impeachable and, you know, they, you know, like you said, I said, tell me what you remember from 1970.
Well, she was wearing a yellow jacket. Yeah. Are you sure it was yellow? It could have been green.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, I mean, how do you remember?
It's got to be just something such, something solid enough. But I do believe it is, you know, we even said it in our episode and the family spokesperson said it multiple times that, you know, if you were scared of speaking out before because of fear of this person, well, this person is a retired senior now, you know, like if you were scared of not being believed, well, things have changed in police investigations with Crown, with all kinds of things, like things have changed and come forward.
Yeah. And if there was already charges laid and then stayed, there's already evidence that to the point that they probably just need a little bit to push this over and be something that where they're like, yeah, we're going to get a conviction. At this point, it must just not be there. And that happens a lot of time. Like there's a lot of cases where there's a suspect for a long time before this little piece of info or this one person's willing to talk that wasn't before. And that's what it takes to push it over. I'm assuming you went through the old newspaper articles like this. I collected a few that the spokesperson was passing around and it's that was interesting because the initially when I read her name and from the email that when he sent it to me, I read the CBC article, which is very brief, as you said earlier, but the newspaper articles, it was like a compelling read to the point that I'm surprised that it wasn't a major news story. Like as you're reading it, I was hanging off of every word of those articles and there was a lot of information in them, but I guess just not enough.
Yeah, they actually did an amazing job. I know we kind of said like, you know, overarching national media didn't really give this case a lot of attention, but those articles, I don't even know what that was, like the whatever the Winnipeg Free Press, or I can't remember what the name of the paper is in Winnipeg, but it was those are incredibly detailed. And there was multiple articles that were chronicling the case.
May Slay again, like they were concerned that this was gonna happen again.
Yeah, May Slay again, police say, is one of the headlines. Two other girls attacked. Like, you know, they were really on it. And great interviews in there as well.
Yeah. But it's just not enough for it to spread and become a major story. But again, I hate to keep going back to that, but it's just, that's one part of this that it just surprises me that this wasn't, that everybody doesn't know her name. If it happened today in another country, everyone in Canada would know her name.
Yeah. If it happened in, you know, the furthest reaches of Canada, it would be heard in every one of our cities. Cause you know, that's the other thing too, is these types of crimes. I don't know if you've noticed this or not, but, you know, I believe that we as Canadians do mourn when something happens in, you know, like when what happened in Nova Scotia happened, like we, you know, Kate and I were devastated, you know, and we were living in Vancouver. Like, you know, we've seen crimes happen throughout Canada and they seem to cut us a little bit deeper. And I think it's because there's only 30 something million of us instead of a country of, you know, 300 million or a billion. We kind of just feel it, even though we have so much geography. And a case like Geraldine Satie today, and even in the 70s, would have been felt if people knew it, I believe.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And it's very relatable too, because we've all been there where, you know, you're running to the neighborhood store to grab something some evening. That would have been so normal for me to do in the late 80s, early 90s. And nowadays, like I said, my son, I have no problem with him running to his friend that lives eight houses up the street.
Yeah.
Could you imagine the moment of freedom right there? Sorry to interrupt, but that moment of freedom for her where her dad said yes. Her mom gave her $1 at dinner.
So she's got her radio.
She had 39 cents extra in her pocket. So she has $1.39 and she puts on her radio. because she carries this radio on a little shoulder strap with her because music is her escape. Mm. Right. And she is the overwhelming feelings of independence, even though she may not have registered it at the moment, but that's what it was. And a light snowfall on the ground, mm-hmm. New Year's Day, 1970, she's 11 turning 12 in just 19 days. And she's walking to the store, which when I was a kid, the corner store was the safest other place from your house.
Oh yeah.
And like a fun place where you had to candy. Go get candy.
You know, and
like
in
it's
that,
a fun journey to make.
And in then, that moment, she met a monster.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's in every kid has done it. You know, every kid's gone to the corner store to just, you know, pick up some items to make their night better. And
Slurpees in the summertime, yeah. You know, like, or Mr. Freezy's or whatever. And then in the wintertime, being able to go there at night when it's, you know, or not night, but because the sun sets early, you're going there in dark time, you know, like, I don't know. It's the store. It's
yeah.
You know.
And then another tragedy or another tragic part of this on top of it is the fact that it was her family that found her the next morning. And that always seems so overly cruel because the police would have been looking. Mm-hmm. And she was found very near where she came from and where she was going. It just seems cruel that it happened to be a family member that was one of the ones that found her.
Yeah. And I mean, also, I know we already talked about like the panic that he must have felt after she didn't come home after 25 minutes, but also it was nighttime and it was like minus 20 out that night.
Minus 26.
So the, you know, the panic of knowing that your 11-year-old daughter is somewhere where she's not warm and safe at home. And then you have to find her the next morning. I mean, this case is so horribly tragic and it's awful.
But I think what people can do now, and I've asked the spokesperson, this is like, what can people do to help you and to spread the message? And I think really what it is now is people just need to know her name, mm-hmm. know her photo.
Share the story,
get involved in the discussion. They have there's a Facebook group, Justice for Geraldine Sitte, and there's a lot of people who live there at the time or family members that are in there sharing their memories and discussing it. But like, I think it's all about like getting that ball of advocacy rolling to the point that somebody out there feels pressured or compelled to talk. And there's enough of her family alive still, brothers and sisters, that can have closure, and the person who did it, there's enough of their life left that they can face justice.
100%.
I hate hearing those stories where it's, you know, this 88-year-old got arrested for a crime they commit like 70 years ago or something, and it's just like, that's not justice. That's a couple years of free housing at a nursing home, basically.
Yeah, I know. But essentially,
so it's like, I want, when the stories like this, I want it to happen as soon as possible so they pay some kind of price.
100%. Mm-hmm. And I think for people who can join the Facebook group, just the knowledge that there's people who care enough to be part of the conversation and to just show their support, it means so much to all of the families that we help and we cover their stories. It's just the knowledge that there's support out there and mm-hmm. people who want to be part of justice and finding answers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And also, you know, our mainstream media, you know, we're podcasters, we're in a different sort of like sphere, but, you know, if the Fifth Estate or W5 or any of their reporters with all their funding pick up a case like this, then all of a sudden you start to see Manitoba justice move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, when it's podcasters, it's one thing, we're reaching a lot of people, but then when our major outlets go, hey,
if we this could spare happened. 5 minutes on the evening news tonight to share a cold case of anybody, it would mean so much to these cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think we need to push for that.
Yeah. Well, they should be doing it. And it's, I think in Halifax and in Nova Scotia, what often happens is I see the police or RCMP when there's a like an anniversary of a case, there may be a little post or something they put online or a press release, but why not like, you know, do something beyond that. Like they must have good, press kind of public relations kind of people, working for the police force. It doesn't take a lot of effort to put something nice together and send it as a press release and get the story out there. That
like a 30-second commercial spot, even like on like during the news at night. Yeah. I mean, they used to. I think Global was doing that for a while for unsolved cases, but they should make it in like an every night thing with a different story or even
Absolutely.
Weekly.
Absolutely, I've been saying that for a while now. Like after all the fallout of the Gabby Petito case and a lot of this mainstream media was criticizing itself for not covering more stories of diverse nature. And I'm like, would you literally have the power to run a 5-minute piece at the end of every single newscast that you do? You could run 5 minutes. That's 365 cases right there.
Yeah, it's true. And the Gabby Petito case was a missing woman in missing young woman in the States. And so much criticism was like, there was so much attention.
Yes.
For a missing white blonde woman with a nice background and all this kind of stuff. People were critical of it. But as you said, like the media was kind of covering it and criticizing themselves.
Yes.
But as I was reading a few of those articles, I was so offended because I was like, they want to cover Gabby Petito, but they don't want to be criticized. So
that's exactly what they were doing. It was still clickbait.
It was still clickbaity.
They're still covering it. Yeah.
They're just covering it in the only kind of context they can.
Exactly.
Yeah. And
so
then they're like, well, nobody's talking about blank. It's like, well, we are. Yeah. You are.
You
Christy
can.
Is. We all like the podcasters are all doing it. Mm-hmm. Like, go for
or
it.
Or trying know? To. I yeah. mean, you know, but yeah. we only have so much like money, resources, and connections to people. Not everybody wants to talk to a small podcast,
but they
all want to talk to CBC.
Yeah. Yeah. But it
not calling CBC out. You're doing a great job.
But it also is like it speaks to with that case, Gabby Petito, it speaks to when the public gets involved in a case gets a ton of attention, things can happen. In that case, there was so much attention that every decision law enforcement was making, I'm sure they double, triple checked everything.
They were terrified, 100%. Yeah.
And Dog the Bounty Hunter was banging on the guy's parents' house. Like it was, everybody was all over it. There was no way that case wasn't getting solved and closed.
No, and it was crazy.
And not every case will get that kind of attention, but every case deserves attention, you know, and deserves the best from law enforcement. And sadly, it doesn't seem like Geraldine maybe didn't get either.
Yeah,
no.
Something happened. Something like that's what we need to know is what piece, because I do believe the police did their job and I believe that the Crown wanted a conviction, but something happened along the line where a piece got missed or a piece of evidence was lost, sullied. Something happened that it was like, okay, well, this is what our whole case is hanging on, and it's got to go away now. But why not another kick at the can in 50 years?
And thankfully they didn't go to trial with no evidence, because that would have been an even worse outcome, I think, if he was found not guilty or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm thankful that, like, you know, we do need to meet a burden
of proof,
proof to bring people to justice. But what happened that couldn't have gone forward? I think that's what the family deserves to know at the end of the day. That's what we need from the Winnipeg police or the RCMP now.
Well, I'm not quite sure who's
I think right? I hope it's Winnipeg police, because that's what I said in my episode. I don't believe the RCMP are in charge of Winnipeg.
I'm not from Manitoba. I'm sorry, I don't know
either.
Well, let's end it with this, but for people who want to hear your coverage of Geraldine's case, where can they find it?
They can find it on any platform that they listen to podcasts.
Yeah, True North, True Crime. I think it's episode 37.
This has been fantastic. I'm sure this is going to happen again. I might as well schedule us for 3 or 4 months from now.
Yes, yeah.
The next eclipse.
We would love
to end up in the same areas of Canadian
crime. Wasn't there
just
a lunar eclipse too? So this is kind of like strange that this is happening on the lunar eclipse.
I don't know. But here we have, I know there's a full moon. But
we should do an episode about this.
Yeah, we should.
I want to thank you for joining True North, True Crime, and I for a discussion surrounding the murder of Geraldine City. If you have any information regarding this case, please contact Crime Stoppers, Winnipeg Police, or if all else fails, contact me and I can get the information to the proper people and keep you anonymous. And with that, we'll begin to wrap up this episode. But before we part, I have some thanks. First, a big thanks to True North True Crime for again sharing an evening with me and the listeners of Nighttime. A big shout out to Monty Data for contributing the music for this episode. And lastly, a massive thanks to everyone who listens to Nighttime, as without your interest and your support, the show would be as pointless as it would be impossible. But that said, keeping the show alive is and has always been an uphill battle, so if you want to help take a bit of weight off the show's back, make sure you're listening on the premium feed. For about the price of a cup of coffee, you can give the show a big hand at patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. And on the topic of the premium feed, let me thank the newest subscribers. Miranda, Christina, and David, thank you for going premium. And for anyone else who'd like to support the show but can't do it financially, you can give me a big hand by simply sharing the episodes on social media and letting like-minded friends know what we're doing here. If you have any story ideas or if you want to give feedback on the show, find me at nighttimepodcast.com/contact and follow me on social media. I use Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and I'm often live on the Nighttime Podcast YouTube channel. So until next time, take care of each other, hug your loved ones tight, and let me know if you see anything weird.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.
It is a lunar eclipse. I knew I was right. I was like,
would it be? It'd be the same here, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the moon's still the same moon, right?
So, yeah, that's right. Well, no, I just felt like I meant like, does it line up the same? But yeah, I guess like the sun and the moon are far enough away that Winnipeg, Vancouver to Halifax isn't.
Yeah.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.